Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Ron Kay from the Conscious Contact Speakers Group in Doylestown, PA.
Hello, hello, hello. My name's Ron. And this is amazing. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a couple home groups. Similar to I bring in speakers at Doylestown on a consistent basis every week. And I was thinking, like, they don't just let anybody stand up here and speak. I mean, you got to pass a really vigorous test, a barrage of questions. And Jack hit me with them yesterday. He's like, listen, our speaker canceled. Can you speak? And do you have a suit and tie? And I thought to myself, well, I do have a suit and tie and nowhere to wear it, so I might as well say yes. So I'm your speaker tonight. There's absolutely nothing special about me. I'm just a regular alcoholic. And I believe God has a sense of humor, because I was thinking, you know, our stories may be different, how we got here. 31 years ago, I was 302 in the Friends Hospital, put in a straitjacket. And I remember one of the most important things my correspondent said to me, he said, Ron, AA is like a mental thing. We get a date first. And I got the papers to prove it. So hopefully tonight, I'm not talking about mental papers, but I can show a message of hope and recovery. I actually believe that. Reason why I feel that way is because I live my life. I live this story. And I've been to great things. You ever hear people when they say, you know, I hated my life. I wanted to kill myself, but I didn't have the guts, you know. And I'm here to tell you that what I found out, like, I actually did try to kill myself, and I did a really good job. And what I'm here to tell you is that it doesn't take guts. This amount of suffering on this planet that I cannot stand another day on. I cannot stand to be on this planet. It's, life is too hard. Get me off of here. And with hindsight, looking at my life, I had a pretty good life. Okay? Through my eyes, it was like the worst life in the world. My vision was skewed. The way I thought and reacted to people was different than others. I had learning disabilities early on. I didn't even know this. So when I look back with hindsight and I review my life, the things that happened early on at a young age, I think it was probably around third or fourth grade, we were all given like these little speeches, like, you know, 4 score 7 years ago, Gettysburg Address, and we had a week to study them, each person in our class, right? So I went home and I spent a whole week studying this thing, and I had to get up in front of the class just like now, and I had to recite this, and I got the first sentence done. And all the other kids had no problem reciting their whole paragraph or whatever. I couldn't do it. And I just knew. And with all the effort that I put into this, I just could not get schooling. I didn't know I had these disabilities. I wouldn't even really know them until my middle son was diagnosed with them in school. My wife had said, you know, he's got learning disabilities. And she would tell me what they were. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm exactly the same way. So this separated me. This made life extremely hard for me. I'm not one of those guys, you know, people get up here, they say, you know, like, you know, I tested really well, I did really good in life, I had great sports, and I couldn't pass a test to save my life. I was terrible at sports. I was just a born loser at life. Alcohol was like a perfect fit. My whole family tree has been decimated from alcoholism and drug addiction. Everywhere. It was just a norm. You worked hard, you drank hard, and that was the purpose of life. I remember reading, like, I think it was the Romans and the Greeks, and they used to talk about the nectar of the gods, you know? And I don't know if any of you guys from the 70s had any of those T-shirts. I was one of those guys that, you know, had the shirt and said, alcohol is proof that there is a God. I mean, long before I ever got to AA, I knew alcohol was my God. It was what I lived for. Most people on planet Earth do not get that kind of feeling. It does not, it does not represent that kind of importance in their life. They can go have a couple drinks. They can have fun with the dinner. They can go home. That wasn't my case. So the schooling part of it, growing up, no different than most people. I don't know. I just bumbled through. Alcoholism in the family tree. Here, let me give you a typical Thanksgiving. You know, my Uncle Nick, he went to Vietnam and he came back with a heroin problem and all other kind of drugs. And we would have Thanksgiving dinner. And we would start it around, my grandmother would make it, it would be about 11 o'clock. And we'd be there all day. And Uncle Nick would stroll in about 5 p.m. and he'd sit down at the table. They'd give him a dish of food and he would nod out face first in that food. Face first. And everybody went on like nothing was happening. Like this was just normal. And my father would say, "See, that's why you don't do drugs." And still today, what I've learned is that's an ominous warning I failed to heed. And so that abnormality, that's just normal, that was my life. My grandfather would drink a fifth of VO and a case of beer and then go out to the bar all night. And like, that's normal. Like, I didn't know that. I knew that was a lot of alcohol. I'm thinking to myself, that's a lot of alcohol. You know, come full circle, that would eventually be me. You know, Bill's story to me, I always hated Bill's story because I was like, I'm completely different than Bill. Until you get to page 5, when he talks about alcohol ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity. And that's what ties us all together in here. At one point in our life, the joy of either drinking or using whatever you used was fun. But then it took me over, and I had to have it at the price of whatever I had to pay. And it didn't really matter. I didn't care. I had nothing else in my life at that point. It was running down. But anyway, let me go back through the school stuff. I go through school. I'm nothing but problems my whole life. I get ideas in my head, and I would just act on them. Just act on them. There was at a grade school, they had this sign up in this chain, "Do not go on the roof." What do you do? I had to go up there and see what was up there. So they call my father to the principal's office, and they're like, "You know what? 72 years of school's been here. He's the first kid to ever go out there." And then first of the questions that would always be asked me my whole life, my father would turn to me and go, "What is wrong with you? What is wrong with you?" And if people have been saying that to you all your life and you don't know, welcome. Because I didn't know. I mean, that's pretty, what is wrong with you? I don't know. Thank God we got a book today that gives us a definition of what the alcoholic is and how I thought and how insane I was. So anyway, that's just a simple, you know, how my upbringing went. And I went through the high schools. That was great. Hated school. Hated every minute of it. Didn't understand it. Couldn't stand being there. Couldn't focus. Couldn't pay attention. And I would just be disruptive. So I had this plan, go on co-op. I'd work half a day, go to school, go half a day of school. And it was a good idea. And I went to work, and I was making good money. And I told the story I was making $175 a week, going to school for a few hours and working the rest of the day. So I had plenty of money to drink and go to do what I had to do. So life was beautiful in my world, except for getting up in those mornings for school. My lifestyle did not afford me the ability to get up in the morning and show up at school. And I couldn't understand the importance of school. And being the genius that I am, I decided to drop out. That was a big step in my alcoholism. You hear guys when they come in. I heard this one guy speak, and he got sober when he was 62 years old, right? And he's telling his story, and I think he was like 65 or 67 at the time. And he's like, you know, he's apologizing the whole time because nothing bad happened to him. He never lost a wife, never lost a job, never lost a house, never lost his license, never had a DUI. He said, nothing really bad happened. He said, just for 30 years, I would go to work, I go home, go down the basement, drink a fifth, pass out, wake up, and do it again. And he's apologetic. And I would sit there, and when the time opened up the floor to share, you know, I put my hand up. I said, "You got one of the saddest stories I've ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous." He looks at me like I'm crazy. I said, "It took you 62 years to find Alcoholics Anonymous. 62 years, you know?" And some of us that are here younger, that got here earlier, this is a blessing. It doesn't feel like it. Didn't feel like it to me. You know, I was coming here. I was just going to hang out here maybe 60 or 90 days. Maybe I'll give you guys a shot. Maybe 6 months. Thank God that there was people in these rooms that shared where they'd been and how their life had turned around as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew they'd been to where I'd been. I knew they'd been there, and I knew there was hope, a message of hope they gave me, if nothing else. And I really, you know, I'm a product of, a lot of people say, I chose to get sober, I choose not to drink. That's not my case. I did not choose this. I did not know I had a problem. I went through three rehabs, and this is what I told them for 28 days. I said, listen, I'm not an alcoholic. I could stop if I want to. I just don't want to. I just didn't want it. And I couldn't understand how anybody would want to live sober on purpose. It really made no sense to me. What was the purpose of life if you're going to take away the one thing that I love most in this world? So those rehabs were a waste of time. But after 28 days in those rehabs, at the end, we'd have our big books and we'd get them all signed and people would be like, yeah, you know. And for a minute, in my mind, I said, you know what? I'm going to give this stuff a try. I'm going to give this a shot. Yeah, you know what? I'm going to turn over a new leaf and I'm done drinking for good, you know. And I'd walk out that door and they'd tell me make meetings and do stuff like that. And I'd wave and I'd have all these great intentions. And as soon as I would walk out, and then I'd think about a meeting and fear. Fear would cripple me. I couldn't walk into a meeting. Oh my God, people scare me. It's so hard. Even when I'm sitting, when I stand up here in the podium, if you understand how I think, the things that I think in my mind, I really want to say, stop looking at me. I don't like people looking at me. I mean, that is part of my alcoholism. That's my fears. This is not a natural place for me to be in front of the podium. I can never understand why people want to stand up here on purpose. This is very, very hard for a person like me. So anyway, those three rehabs, I actually believed that I had the power to stop if only circumstances, and I really wanted to, and I had no reason that I want to. And there was one thing that really, I think that the greatest example I have of my alcoholism before it really went off the tracks was I was about 19 years old, and I'm working down in Philadelphia, and I had met this woman, and I said, you know what, I'm going to take her out for a lunch date. So I take her out on this lunch date at Seafood Shanty on the Roosevelt Boulevard. If you older guys maybe know what that is, right? So being the class dude that I am, I'm sitting there with some food, and I see this bottle of something somebody orders. I'm like, give me a bottle of that. And they're like, it's Asti Spumante. I'm like, that's right up my alley, right? So I pour her some, and I pour me some. And my intentions were pure when I was going there. Get with this girl and have some lunch with her, right? But I had that drink. And I wound up finishing that bottle myself. Dropping her off at work and heading right down to Pat McGinnis' tavern in the DL. And I remember not going back to work all that day. And the next day, when I went into work, they're like, hey, Ron, what happened to you yesterday? And I'm like, you know what? I said, I don't know how anybody can go out drinking on their lunch date and go back to work. And I didn't know anything about the powerless. I knew nothing about the physical allergy. I just knew that I couldn't start drinking until I was done work because all bets were off. There was nothing that was going to happen once I get that first drink. I'm chasing that next one and the next one and the next one. And the heck with that job, the heck with that girl, the heck with everything. And that is my first example of my powerless over alcohol and my physical allergy. That wasn't enough to even... That wasn't until hindsight that I could see that, but I knew how I had to drink. And from that age on, what it took place that was a major, major change in my life. You know, I always hear these guys that I would probably be happy living at home at mom and dad's house, you know, in the basement, drinking up my whole life away. My whole life. But something came that shocked me and rattled my whole world. And I was like, right at age 19, my father gets cancer and he's diagnosed with that and gave him 3 months to live. And all of a sudden, my world that I really didn't like turned to this like black, gray, unbearable place. And I remember going with him, and I remember taking him for chemotherapy, and I remember that. And I remember, you know, I am not a God person. I am not a religious person, even though I was directed there and I had to go to a Catholic grade school. I just didn't get it. And I didn't believe in a God up until this point, when I felt that I was a victim. And I was like, wow, my world was like shaking and rattled. So I'm taking them, and while I have two brothers and two sisters, and while that's happening, my mother's making dinner. At 38 years old, she has a massive heart attack and dies. And now, I am ruined for life. I have a black hole inside me, inside my brain, and no amount of alcohol can fill. And my best thinking and my goal is to drink myself and be dead in 2025, and that was my goal. I just didn't want to believe. I couldn't understand why anybody would go, this is like the worst place in the planet Earth. It's too painful for us. I can't live in reality. I can't. I'm such a victim. And everything was coming at me. Everything in my life was happening to me and at me, and I couldn't see anything. I had no tools. I had no tools to live in this world. So what had happened there, like I said, after getting out of that mental institute, and I told you about that next year and how things got like incredibly worse. And I love in Bill's story where he says, two or three bottles of gin a day became the norm, however he words it. And then in the next paragraph, and he says, and then things got worse. And that was exactly after that mental institute. I wound up getting involved with a lot of stuff and a lot of bad people and a lot of bad things. And what eventually happened is I wound up getting shot with a .44 Magnum in the lower abdomen. It went right through me, and I should have been dead. And so I get sent to a hospital in Philadelphia. In fact, it was like the worst hospital in Philadelphia. It's out of business. People go in with nosebleeds and die. I don't know how they put me together, and still I was, that wasn't enough for me to stop, and I still tried to make it work. And the insanity of that, trying to, it went on and on and on and on, and it was a mess. Anyway, so circumstances keep going. I'm looking at a 5-year sentence in jail. Okay, I only got to do two things: give 2 urines per month, and I don't have to go to jail. It's a great deal for a guy like me. I'm all in. And I have every intention of doing it. Every intention. There's no way I want to spend 5 years of my life in jail. Problem is, I'm an alcoholic. And I can't make it. I can't do those urines. And I had this, I'll never forget this judge. I had the most angriest woman judge in the whole world. And I think she had like an agenda. Maybe you heard of her. Her name is Lynn Abram. That woman saved my life. I didn't report, and the PO called me, and I said, blank that blank. And she said, 6 months for each one of those blanks. And I got a year thrown at me real quick. And that was a moment of sanity in there, and I would do anything to get out. And I was finally to a point where I might want to give this a shot. And I went to a rehab, Fairmount Institute. Nothing great there. I actually bought drugs with me. I figured I'm going to get sober. What is it going to take? I need 90 Valiums for 28 days. That's 3 Valiums a day. I'm sober, right? Problem is, I'm an alcoholic. And we still to this day, we don't know how long they lasted me. But I was forced against my will to get sober, in sober terms. I'll never forget it. This guy saved my life. And he was a counselor. He had one eye. He was an alcoholic. He had gotten in a car accident, lost his eye in a car accident. And I'm the kind of person that people always came at me all the time. And I had all the tools to survive in this world when people come at me. But this was the first gentleman who ever just talked to me kindly and softly. And I had no defense against a gentleman. And for a minute, I just went, and I was able to be free. And I could let go a second and hear what this man had to say, because he wasn't telling me. He was telling his story. Let me tell you what happened to me, and let me tell you what it's like now. The man lived spiritual principles beyond anything I could grasp at the time. But there was something about him and the way he took him and the love that he showed me that would profoundly change my life. I'd spent three and a third years going to his aftercare after that. Anyway, what had happened was my halfway house, or my, what do you call that, aftercare in the Fairmount Institute was the Salvation Army. And I tell people, I will never, ever, ever, ever be that humble again in my life. And I'm in the Salvation Army, and I'm looking around, and I'm not like these people. I'm not like these guys in the Salvation Army. Come on, man. These are real bums. I'm a class dude, I know I don't have a home, but that's just temporary. I know I don't have a job. I'm unemployable, but that's just temporary. I'm a mess. I'm delusional. And I can't differentiate the truth from the false. So God led me along and put people in my path. And I stumbled into a clubhouse in Philadelphia, Life or Death. And that name, Life or Death. They're being a little, dramatic. I really did. I'm like, these guys are ones. But anyway, where I come to find out that this is Life or Death. This is a lecture test. 6 months ago, my younger brother took his own life as a result of this disease. Traumatic. Sad. Unneeded. Unwarranted. He had been sober 7 years and spent 12 years trying to get back to this program. I wonder, it's sad. And I see that in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My children, you see, I failed to give this back enough. I gave you guys a good 7 years of my life. I gave you 7 years of my life. Okay? Selfish and self-centered. You guys gave me a life. I had nothing when I came here. And I forgot that. It wasn't until my own children needed this program and came back and I took them to AA and like that. We didn't hear a bunch of people from the conference and become a God. You know, my kids lied in this program and I had to re-engage and reevaluate my program and where I was. And that's why I'm here tonight. I hope, you know, if my own children, which I hope, you know, maybe, you know, I don't know how long I have on this plan, but the two most important things could do in the program of recovery, if I was talking to my own children, I'm not talking to you, I would tell them to make at least one big book study a week and one hour speaker meeting a week where you hear a message of hope and recovery. And if you can, make two big book studies a week and 2 1-hour speakers where you hear a message of hope and recovery. Because it's that important. And I love that type of, I love to hear recovery. I love to be in recovery. You know, there's a lot of common sense that I didn't even see, and a lot of us don't see, even sitting in the room, you know, we think, like, you know, the goal was just to be physically sober, and we clap for the coin, and that's all great, that's the beginning. What this program had to offer to me is far beyond that. If I would have settled for that, if I walking in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you said, listen, Ron, the best I can give you, 2 years sober, 10,000 in cash. I would have thought I hit the lottery. And that's been like 30 years ago, and I understand this disease more than ever today. I understand the seriousness of it. I understand the rewards of it. And the reason, you know, I'd like to tell you that I didn't do all this stuff work and all this big book work out of any kind of virtue of my own. You know, I thought to myself, I said, you know what? I didn't believe this steps work, and a friend of mine, Chris S., until he said it, I thought I was the only guy that did this. I thought to myself, I'm going to do those steps just to show you that they don't work. They will not work on a guy like me. I don't believe in God. And the amazing thing is, a person like me, that when I walked in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you would put a gun to my head and said, say the word God or talk about God, I'm going to pull the trigger now. That's it. See, I didn't even know this, but my number one resentment was against the God I didn't believe in. Now, there's no way, you know, Einstein, I think, says it best. He says, you can't solve a problem with the same mind that created it. My problem is my thinking. I thought it was just the drinking when I come to AA, and I thought if I stopped it, be fixed. But it wasn't. It was my thinking. I'm full of resentments and fears. I put a drink down. I can't manage in this world. I'm full of fear. I can't even, everything in this whole world, afraid of light, afraid of dark, afraid of cold, afraid of hot, afraid of crowds, afraid of being alone. Now this is really like the insanity of it. I cannot win. I go jumping around. I think external things are going to fix all this stuff. And I think every single person that comes into AA, the first thing, you know, the first thing that we know, the cure for alcoholism when you come in here, well, you stop drinking, you get a good job, get to work a little overtime, get a significant other, work on your abs. You know, there's a beginners meeting that I go to, and they start out the meeting, letting people with less than 6 months share how they stayed sober this weekend, and it kills me. I want to put my hand up and say, listen, you know, how did I stay sober this week? I just went to the gym and worked on my abs a week, and took a lot of selfies and posted them on Facebook, because it seems like everybody's doing that. You know, this journey has been so amazing. And there's so many things that I hear and see throughout AA today that I can see clearly that I couldn't see in the beginning. And it was a lot of great men. I've had a team of sponsors and guys. You know, they call them sponsors. I like to call them mentors. Mentors, that's all. Good men that are willing to take the time to show you. I'm big on CDs and recorded messages of hope and recovery. I tap into that. I gravitate towards positive people that are about recovery. I surround myself with them because I'm a manic depressant at heart. Now, if you know me, when I'm serious as a heart attack when I'm at this podium, but when I'm away from this thing, man, life is like a joke. All I do is laugh all day long and enjoy this place. And that was something that I couldn't do before. And that's a pretty powerful way for me to see where I'm at in my program. Am I able to laugh? Am I able to enjoy life? See, my wife said, you know, you used to be such a serious person, and everything was so important. And that's truly, it ruled my life. I mean, I used to think everything was so important. My lawn would look like it was artificial. It would be so green, and every hair, every fiber would be exact. You know, I was out to eat at a restaurant with an alcoholic a while ago, and we walk in, and when the guy seats us down, and I said to him, after the guy said, I said, did you notice he was missing a belt loop? He's like, yeah. I said, that drives me crazy. I'm like, I want to tell this guy. Now, these are the things that give me the illusion that I am smart. I notice a lot of stuff. And what happens is, it bothers me. I have like this OCD. I have every single letter after my name that you don't want. none of the good ones. You know, here's another example of things that bother me. There's this one tennis player. I'm a tennis player. I watch tennis, and she has two tattoos, and they're in weird spots. They're like off down by the elbow, and I watch, and all I can think about is that they got to be moved. And like normal people, I cannot. Why does that bother me? That's insanity. And I cannot even focus on the game because all I can see are these tattoos the whole time. Now, these kind of things, I go through life. And I notice. And I remember there was a reporter woman who got shot with two other guys. A guy just killed him. I guess it was about a year or two ago. And I don't even watch the news anymore, but I'm flicking through the channels, and then there's an FBI guy, and he's talking, and they're reading, like, his emails. And they said, you know, the shooter, they said he was a injustice collector. I'm like, oh, my God, that's me. I'm an injustice collector. I'm a scorekeeper in life. I go through life seeing everything that's wrong. I can't be okay with it. I can't just walk away. I can't. And why? And what happened? So now I need to be in this big book. And why do I need to do that? Because the fact that I'm in conflict with everything on this planet constantly. And I cannot see that. And I think the whole world is wrong, and Ron's the only right guy here. That's it. That, and the whole planet, 7 billion people, what are the odds of me being right? Well, they're minuscule. We'll give it that. But there is a chance, you're saying, right? That's the story of my life, though. And I actually believe my head, and I believe these things, and I cannot separate from them. And so I'm the kind of guy that just cannot just not drink. And here's another example. I mean, you know, we look at speakers, and you look at the outside, you look, hey, man, you know, the guy's like showered and washed or whatever, he's got some clean clothes, and you figure, this is what goes through my head, early sobriety. Beautiful sunny day, I'm walking down the street, I don't even know where this is coming from. All of a sudden, I just want to get a baseball bat and crack every person I see across the head, break every windshield and every window, and I am like, but I'm just walking, and you're like, yeah, this guy looks kind of relaxed. And I can't identify where this is coming from. Coming from myself. And what happens is, little by little, I think the key was the willingness to seek this. You know, our first step, and I love this analogy. Our first step, which is vitally important to every single one of us, which I think is probably the most misunderstood step in the world. We admit we were powerless over alcohol, and that's a tough one, right? You know, I don't know about you guys, but I have exhibited power in times in my life, for brief periods of time, whatever it is, and I couldn't understand that powerlessness. And if you know, there's a lot of people in AA, maybe they stop for a day, a week, a month, a year, whatever it is, and in the mind it takes them back. And the best way I can explain the powerlessness is, first of all, if I'm powerless over water, that'd be pretty much a gimme, right? I need water to live and survive, right? So you'd give me that, right? But what if I spent a lot of time at sea, and this is what made me think of this. What if I told you I was powerless over salt water? And if you know anything about salt water, it's completely toxic to the human being. It actually kills you faster than not drinking at all. And I am totally powerless over it. And why am I powerless over it? If I'm at sea, my boat sinks, I'm set adrift, I know, I've spent enough time at sea, I know I can't drink that salt water. I know that in my mind, there's no way I'm drinking that water, there's no way it's going to kill me, it's no way, there's no way in a million years I'm drinking it. That's day one. Day two, sun's beating on me, I'm getting thirsty, lips are starting to get dry, mouth is starting to get dry, I'm surrounded by water, but there's no way I'm drinking that water. I know it's poison, it's death, and there's no way I'm going to drink it. Day three comes. Now I'm getting real. Now thirst is beyond thirst. You know, I got powder in my mouth. My lips are cracking up. My head's splitting up. And I'm just roasting out there, and I'm surrounded by water. And yet I still know it's not good for me. But I need one other thing to happen. What happens is my mind gives up hope. They're not going to find me. I'm going to die out here. There's no way I'm going to make it. And that's when my mind says, you know what? Just a little drop. Just touch it to your lips. Get some relief. Just a touch. And then before you know it, I take a touch and I get a little bit of relief and then I want more. And I wind up drinking the very thing that I swore I would never take that I know is poison. And the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is my thirst quencher. That's what I need. A 12-step program to quench my thirst, to keep me from getting thirsty enough in sobriety that a drink looks like the option. You know, we sit in Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of times we'll sit here and we'll identify what causes, you know, relapse or drinking, and people will talk about resentments and fear. Oh, the list can go on and on. And the main thing that I'll put out to you, and think about this: the number one cause of relapse is sobriety. Sobriety. I cannot stand another day sober. That's the insanity of alcoholism. I have to find contentment and happiness in this program, sober. I got to find a way to become happy, joyous, and free. And walking in the doors, just putting down the drink, I am the same person, full of all the resentments and fears, running on self-will. Just like the book talks about being a tornado in the life, I can be more destructive sober than I was drinking. More selfish, more needy. When I was drinking, I would pass out and probably save myself a lot of problems and amends. You know, sober, I'm running on full steam. And look out. And I have a hole to fill, and I don't know it. And I found this has been my experience. For a long time, you know, I believe some of the rewards, you know, of sobriety are material possessions. You know, you would always hear that in the rooms, you know. And a lot of times when I sit with guys and I go, you know, what are the true rewards, you know, of sobriety? And they would be like, you know, well, a job, a house, a car, a driver's license. But for me today, the true reward is peace and serenity, happiness, and joy. And I have meaning and purpose in my life. I can't wait for you. Cannot wait. I can't wait till Thursday. I get so excited. Monday nights we do a big book study with a bunch of guys at a house, and it's so cool, and I had to miss it tonight. And the guys are like, we're making tacos. I mean, this stuff is amazing. I can afford to be doing anything I want tonight, and I'm here with you guys. This is more power. There's nothing that you could pose to me and say, hey, Mom, I'd rather be doing this. No, I'd rather be doing that. No amount of material stuff. Yeah. And you know, this goes pretty much around throughout the world, and I constantly, like, review what's going on. A friend of mine that's a doctor in the emergency room of Doylestown, and he's been a doctor for 28 years in the emergency room. And one day we're at the gym working out, and I asked him, I said, hey, Rob, let me ask you a question. Has anybody in your 28 years here, has anybody on their deathbed ever asked for a gold bar, a supermodel, and a Ferrari? He's a doctor. He's serious. He ponders. He looks at me, he's like, no. I said, yet my whole life I've been searching for these material things, and I've had the luxury to face my own mortality several times recently and evaluate what is important in life. That's actually a gift. I actually have 4 stents in me. I have 20% of my heart working, a pacemaker defibrillator, and I do not have one single problem in this world. This is amazing. I have a God of my understanding. Let me go back to 2 Christmases ago. I wake up, I'm having this heart attack. Fun. You know, I do them every day. My wife's like, you think you should go to the hospital? No. She's like, she takes me over. Anyway, the first doctor comes in. He's like, looking me over. Starts to get a little, you know, he's looking. He brings a second and third doctor over. They're getting a little nervous. Next thing you know, my wife's getting nervous. Next thing you know, I start to get a little feared up and nervous. And I said to him, I said, listen, I said, I'm like breathing. Do me a favor. Give me 5 minutes alone. 5 minutes. And they left and they gave me that 5 minutes. And I immediately went to God and I said, God, I said, I'll tell you what, you have given me a life second to none, second to none. And if this is the end of it right now, you know, I'm okay with that. I'm okay. However, if I walk out of this hospital, you have work for me to do. And at that moment, a peace and calm came over me. And for the next 6 days, I was in that heart ward and down at the lounge. And we were holding big book studies and people from AA are coming over there. It was like goofy as crap. And I never laughed so hard. I mean, the funniest thing is like they have the board and they have the people's names up, right? Like Joe S., Bill W., whatever, and Ron K. And people would come and the nurses were like, who are you? I said, I would point to the board. I'm like, I'm Ron K. And I bust up laughing. I crack myself up today. You know, I can just have fun and I can laugh at life and I can walk this planet a free man. You know, I'm able to be a good person and practice these principles in all my affairs. You know, the one thing I do, you know, those learning disabilities have given me the ability to quote page by page and be sound, you know, like I, you know, standing up here talking, you know, I mean, speaking, this is the booby prize in AA. You know, we hear all through AA, it works if you work it. You never hear it works if you know it. Me sounding good up here, quoting a lot of stuff is no good. What I watch is people's feet. Do their feet match their actions? Okay. I hope my feet match my actions. I probably spend between 6 and 12 hours a day on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And not one of that 6 to 12 hours a day is spent on keeping myself sober. I put zero effort into that. God handles all of that for me today. I just do his work. And I'm not suggesting that anybody go that deep into this unless you really want the rewards that I get, which I love. I get something that's far priceless, more than any amount of money or any kind of objects have given me. And I've searched for it all through this world, all different ways. And at one time, I thought those zeros in that checkbook and were the most important thing in my life. And if I just got a bigger house, another shore property, another boat, another vacation, another country, you know, I ran out of places and things to buy. And then I was left with the worst thing I could possibly be left with in this world. Myself. And that is the most dangerous place for a guy like me. I need every one of you guys. I need you guys. You guys are we are all one. You got the energy of God works through every single one of you and it fills my soul. And when I feel connected in here, I feel connected. Any meeting that I walk in Alcoholics Anonymous anywhere in this world. Here, I'll tell you a story. I went to Mexico. This is probably 25, 30, 27 years ago. And I'm like all worried. It's the first time I'd done a skillion meetings and I'd never miss a meeting. And then my first sober vacation and I take big book with me and all these reading books and these Joan Chorda cassettes and all these things with me. And I get on a plane. I'm like, I land in Mexico. They said they have meetings there. And I'm like, oh, great. And I get a meeting list and I go to this meeting and I walk in. And I'm like, holy crap. They speak Spanish here. but it was amazing because the guy's like, I understood. I could feel. I was reading his mind, and I knew I was home. And it's an amazing part of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, like I'm such an idiot. You know, like who knew that they didn't speak English in Mexico? Anyway, I get to laugh at how crazy I am today. You know, these are just a few of the rewards. My son is actually sober. The three greatest joys that probably any person could bestowed upon them is my three sons being born. And you know, I didn't believe when they talked about this disease being hereditary. That was the one thing. I buy everything about this program, but no, the great and powerful Ron will raise sober kids. You watch. And apparently God said I need a first step experience of my about how powerless I truly am, and how over the whole of life, I've done everything in my power to raise those kids sober, you know, and they had their journey, and it was much like mine. You know, my parents had, you know, you can't make an alcoholic and you can't stop one from drinking. And my parents and my lifestyle growing up didn't make me an alcoholic. I was just driven towards it. And I could see at a young age how my children were driven towards that. And, you know, to have them sober today, that's a miracle. You know, my middle son, I love them all to death. They never keep me from laughing. My middle son's like, "Pop, you know, I got a good job in California. They let me take home all I want." And I'm like, "Take home all you want? You're in the tiling business." He's like, no, growing medical marijuana. I'm like, "I don't know how that can go wrong." I said, "I spend my life trying to get people sober, and you're going to help get them drunk and high." I said, "Good luck with that, son. I love him to death. He's got a woman, girlfriend now. They have a son due in a couple months, and that's going to be a joy." And then my youngest one, God bless them all. These were some of the gifts. I had some of the greatest years of my life with my sons. Of all the material things and everything that's transpired and gone through my life, it's those moments when I look back at those pictures when they were small. You know, it's kind of like me and my wife, we're getting older now, and we look at these pictures. You know, I feel like I'm 110 when I'm looking at these pictures. Like I want to, you know, experience. You know, it's like when you buy a puppy and it's so cute, and then it gets big and not as cute. I look at these pictures when they were so small. I'm like, "Oh my God, I was present for that." It's almost like a drug. Like I wish I could go back and still experience some of that. You know, if you have young children, you know, I would say get the most expensive digital camera you can and record as many of the memories, because they are priceless. When you look back on that stuff, I thank God I did that stuff, because my mind cannot remember how many things and moments that we've shared together that were just priceless and great. What a joy. And I would have never experienced that. You know, if I'm walking in, for the new guys are in here, if I was walking in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous and you would have said to me, "You know, one of the gifts of having kids," I would have been, "Kids? Who wants kids?" You know, like that would not have looked like something that I would have definitely wanted. You know, something important I wanted to hit on before we run out of time here. You know, we talk, you know, we read how it works at every single meeting before we start. And, I think it's vitally important that the person take their time with that and read that clearly, because sometimes that's the only bit of true recovery that we hear. You know, in a room full of, you know, you let a guy like me walking into AA and you tell me to put my hand up and share, I'm going to, like, you know, you tell me if I feel like drinking every minute of every day, you know, like, what am I going to do? And we read these 12 steps, and I say the solution to Alcoholics Anonymous, to sobriety, is right in that. And the one single word that's the most important word of all of how it works to me is the word completely. Completely give yourself to the simple program. And why completely is so important? Because half measures avail us nothing. And that's my experience. I only get out of this program what I'm willing to put in. I can want to be sober the most. I could be the person the most wants to be sober in this whole room, but if I'm not willing to take these actions and to persevere through this and do this little bit of work and search for a higher power, I'm going to suffer. I'm going to suffer sober. You know, at the end of how it works, we all say it together: God could and would if he were sought. And I believe in my heart we should ask everybody, who here is seeking God? Okay? If I'm not seeking them, these are questions that I ask myself every day at night. Every morning when I get up, I say the third step prayer on my knees: God, I offer myself to thee. I no longer work for me. My life is not mine. That's a great deal. Thank God. Whew. You know, I used to say it used to be a lot of work being me. And it truly was. I mean, it was a lot of work. And today it's absolutely a joy and simple. My wife's like, "You don't care about nothing." I said, "That's true. It really is true." I mean, I don't care in a sense that I'm like, God has handled it. There's a difference between the belief and faith, and it took a while for me to nurture that and have that connection. You know, our group on Saturday night is called Conscious Contact Speaker Group, and we seek a conscious contact to the point where it becomes an unconscious contact. That's where I am at, and I seek to stay there. It's not a permanent place for me. I have to have diligent work every day and be around this. but the rewards are beyond anything that I could possibly get anywhere else in this world. This is a great gift. How much more time do I have? Well, all right, good. He told me five of. What else did I want to talk on before we get out of here? I don't know. I'm just drawing a blank right now. I think we're pretty much covered this stuff. I hope you guys will just keep coming back and give this a try. I hope you'll seek out. Be here. This is one of the most important things I think my first sponsor told me. He said, no one man has everything this program has to offer. Be a seeker of recovery. And we had so much fun early sobriety. We were the most craziest people. Every Friday night, it was like a 150 or 200 hour Chevy brown crap colored brown wagon with rust holes through the quarter panels, bad inspection stickers. I had no driver's license. I had warrants out. I mean, let me paint this picture how I walked in the door. This is really amazing. So I come in. I didn't have a driver's license for 3 years. Had warrants out for my arrest. I owed $15,000 on my driver's license, $80,000 on credit card scams, facing a 5-year back charge, and had just been shot with a .44 Magnum 9 months prior. And I'm all busted up, and I'm walking to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys have the guts to tell me, just keep coming back, stay sober, and everything will work out. I'm like, yeah, right. You have no clue. I mean, I'm sitting in these rooms. I'm like, these guys don't know my story. And I used to get asked to speak a lot in those early days. And the reason for that, because I had a war story every day. Man, I could speak for 12 hours. You want to tell me, I'll tell you stories. I had no solution. Man, God forbid, we don't want to be like Ron. Like, everything bad. I was like a bad magnet, you know, like, oh, my God. And stupid stuff. I mean, anyway, we could go forever with that there. But anyway, we got the station wagon. On Friday nights, I would get the meeting book, and we would go, you know, just pick a meeting. Oh, that's where we'd go. And that's what we'd do. And we'd throw a bunch of guys, like 8-9 guys, and go to some different meetings somewhere. We wind up in Center City, wind up in New Jersey, doing all kind of goofy crap. We would go out to we would go out for pizza afterwards. We would spend lots of time at the diner. The most important part of any meeting is before the meeting and after the meeting. This hour, I always tell people, you know, this hour of a meeting, this is like a 1-hour college course for me. I need to do 2-3 hours of homework. I do. A guy like me, I'm a real alcoholic. I cannot just, like, sit here and listen. Okay, that sounds good. Maybe someday. I have to be in this. And when I'm in it, life is simple. Life is beautiful. And I have all kinds of support and love around me and good people flowing through me. The minute I start to run on self and I think that, hey, Ron, you know, you really should be working on your tan somewhere down in the South Caribbean somewhere. That mindset, self, I start to feed self. I'm either getting selfless on a daily basis or feeding self, and that's my battle for a time. Look, I want to thank you guys. I want to thank Jack for having me here. I hope I covered enough stuff. Part 2's next week. No, we were just kidding about that. Give him a hand right back, guys.